Everybody dance.
Your Nathan show just makes me glow each weekend night. He's beyond compare and so debonair. He shines so bright.
Here on BZ 103. Oh, please don't turn that dial.
He makes me smile. Norm Nathan Show. Norm Nathan Show. Norm Nathan Show.
This is what you call your basic Norm Nathan show, and I am that person. We're going to be talking with David Pickering, who's the author of a book called The Dictionary of Superstitions. And it's incredible the amount of superstitions there are, just about anything you can think of on any subject. I mean, we all know the usual ones, don't let a black cat cross your path, or cracks in the sidewalks, cracks in your back or something, and all of that kind of stuff, knocking on wood. But there are tons of others, and you wonder, how'd they come about, and why do we have so many superstitions? Anyway, David Pickering, who's in England at this very, very moment, is on the line with us because he's the man who wrote the Dictionary of Superstitions. Glad to talk with you. May I call you David?
You certainly may. Good morning to you.
Thank you very much. You may call me Norm, which is my name also. That you turned your clocks back in England also. What time do you call yourself? I don't mean the time, but for example, Massachusetts is on Eastern Standard Time now. What kind of standard time are you? Do you call it British Standard Time or something?
We've always had Greenwich Mean Time, which is where the Royal Observatory was in London, so it was always taken from there. I have a feeling they've changed the name since then. In the summer, we have British Summer Time, which suits us very nicely.
I like the sound of that even better. Yeah, ours is Eastern Daylight Time, but summertime, that is nice. Where, are you in London?
No, I'm actually in Buckingham, which is an hour or two out of London, going north. So very much slap bang in the middle of England, really.
Okay, and the Cotswolds, you're to the east of the Cotswolds?
Just to the east of the Cotswolds, yes, you're right, yes. Very pleasant area.
Yeah, that is beautiful country up through there, really nice.
It would be looking better this morning if it wasn't windy and rainy. We're having a very English morning, I'm afraid.
Okay. You have, anyway, you've written this, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Hold on a second. Thank you. I turned the microphone off when I sneezed. I should keep it on so people can hear what goes on behind the scenes, I suppose.
Well, that's very interesting. You should sneeze. You understand immediately you've already entered the territory of superstitions. Sneezing on a Sunday is very worrying. You shouldn't have done that. So there's a little rhyme which maybe you know or maybe you don't. Sneeze on a Monday, sneeze for danger. Sneeze on a Tuesday, kiss a stranger. Sneeze on a Wednesday, sneeze for a letter. Sneeze on a Thursday, something better. Sneeze on a Friday, sneeze for sorrow. Sneeze on a Saturday, see your sweetheart tomorrow. Sneeze on a Sunday, which you've just done, your safety seek. The devil will have you the whole of the week. So you've really landed yourself in it now.
Yeah, so there aren't too many days you can sneeze and get away with it. Tuesday, kissing a stranger. Although it doesn't, there's no word after that as to what happens if you just do kiss a stranger, but they'll smack, hit you right off the head with a block of wood or something. Where did you come up with all these superstitions, David Pickering? How do you go about compiling a book like this?
Books on superstitions are sort of few and far between, but books have been written, and it was quite a popular subject going back 100 years or so. So it was a question of finding some of those books, reading everything which had been written on the subject, and sort of mixing the whole lot together and adding in anything else I knew of or sort of had heard tell from. Talking to friends and family and so on, it was quite interesting to see what sort of little glosses they could come up on well-known superstitions. There are certainly many regional variations. Everybody seems to know certain superstitions in a different way, and so you try and give all the variants as much as you can.
Okay, now, I guess just maybe on a philosophical note, why do we have superstitions, obviously, it satisfies some kind of a need in people. What would that be?
Yes, that's right. It's essentially this need people have always felt to protect themselves from the unknown, from uncertain threats from which there is no better protection. If a sudden illness or something like that, particularly in years gone by, there wasn't a great deal you could do. So all you could do really was hope for the best and reassure yourself by protecting your luck. So it's really this urge for reassurance. And maybe this is why we're seeing a bit of a revival in interest in superstitions in the last few years. We're seeing established religion maybe hasn't got quite the hold it once had, and people are looking around for something else. And now, of course, we've got the millennium upon us, and people, again, are wondering what's in store. And so, of course, you get all this renewed interest in odd subjects like superstitions.
Are there lots of superstitions that go back many, many, many years, particularly that go back that far?
Indeed. Well, the one we've just discussed, the sneezing one, for instance, that one, most people in this country will tell you that goes back to the plague, because sneezing was an early symptom of the plague. But in fact, that particular one appears to be much, much older than that. It goes back, in fact, all the way to ancient Greece. The idea was that, in the case of sneezing, was that anything to do with the breath was very closely linked to the soul. So if you sneezed, you could literally sneeze your soul out of your body. And so you had to say a little rhyme or something like that to make sure you retrieved your soul. This is the same thing with yawning. When you cover your mouth when you're yawning, people these days assume that's because it's good manners. What you're really doing is preventing an evil spirit, a demon, from slipping into your body while your mouth is wide open. So, and these ideas go back, back to the beginnings of recorded history.
Does sneezing have? And I mean, I know that you mentioned the problems with sneezing on days of the week and all of that. Does that have anything to do with the devil? Are you sneezing some evil spirit out of your soul when you sneeze?
Well, that's right. That's the idea. Yes. It was such a jolt to the soul. The problem with the soul is the spirit is it's separate to the body, it's within you, but any sort of sudden action like a sneeze or something, and you could lose it. A good example of this is all the umpteen superstitions we have to do with mirrors. The thing about a mirror was that the spirit, found a mirror very interesting. And when you looked in a mirror, you weren't actually looking at your physical reflection. You were actually seeing your soul. It happened to look a bit like you, but it was actually your soul you were looking at. And if you were ill, or perhaps even worse, dying, and you happen to glance into a mirror, because this link between body and soul was a bit weakened, the spirit could get trapped behind the glass. Now, this is very bad news, because if you then died, your spirit couldn't go to heaven or wherever because it was trapped in the mirror. So this is why people would, if somebody was dying in the household, that they'd cover up the mirror. This is a superstition which you still come across these days, particularly with relation to thunderstorms. It's the same idea. And this was doubly worrying, because if you got a spirit trapped inside a mirror, it would be very lonely. And so the next person who looked into the mirror would have their own soul snatched as company by the other soul already in the mirror. So you've got this idea then of the spiritual self is very vulnerable, and you had to protect it by superstition.
It's interesting. Different parts of the body also bring on different kinds of superstitions. I was looking at the section you have, like on fingernails. Now, there's something that you figure is pretty inconsequential, the fingernail, and yet you have a whole big section on that.
Oh, absolutely, yes. This has got a link here with witchcraft, really, in a way, because any part of your body was essentially an expression of yourself, and each part of it had a spiritual essence. So something like fingernails and hair and losing teeth and things, you had to be very careful about what you did with the trimmings and when you did it and how you did it, because this lent you vulnerable to attack by witches. For instance, if a witch got hold of a lock of your hair or some fingernail trimmings, like they could pop it into a cauldron and make a wonderful spell over it and gain magical power over you. So this is one of the sort of things at the root of this. Funnily enough, the strange you should pick out the fingernails, because again, there's another rhyme very similar to the sneezing one, that if you cut them on a Monday, you cut them for health, and so on and so on and so on. Again, you shouldn't do it on a Sunday, because the devil will have you the whole of the week. There are an awful lot of things you mustn't do on a Sunday, because, of course, it's the Sabbath day.
Like what, for example? What other than the couple of things that you have mentioned so far? Since I mentioned that, because obviously we're into a Sunday now, in order to get through this day safely, I'm going along with the superstitions as though they really make sense, and a lot of them I obviously don't. But how can we get through today?
I mean, the one we all know from history really is it's a very bad day to do any serious physical work because this is showing disrespect to the Lord. Not a good day to even make a bed. I mean, something as trivial as that. You're not really supposed to make your bed on a Sunday. Certainly not cut the hair or fingernails. Bad day to cry. It's an intriguing one. There's actually another superstition that you shouldn't laugh on a Friday because that means you'll cry on the Sunday. Of course, you shouldn't laugh on a Friday because it's the day of the crucifixion. So this is the idea here. An awful lot of superstitions have these religious overtones. You should certainly never court anybody on a Sunday. Don't see your girlfriend on a Sunday. You get into trouble. But there are other aspects which are okay on a Sunday. You can actually undergo medical treatment on a Sunday. That's supposed to be... It'll go very well if you have to have an operation or something on a Sunday. A very good day to show generosity to someone else because heaven will notice it and will reward you. So it's not all bad news.
A lot of the superstitions based upon religion... You mentioned you know, it being the Lord's Day and therefore all that. I was thinking, for example, in Judaism... in Orthodox Judaism, not all facets, but in Orthodox Judaism, there are some rules that are so strict. For example, I don't think anybody follows them, but you're supposed to put on one shoe before the other shoe. I forget which foot it's supposed to be, the left shoe before the right shoe. And there are rules for almost every waking moment about everything. Most of these superstitions, many of them do come from religion.
I suppose something in the region of 50% or so have some kind of religious background. So, I mean, you have to be careful here because so one man's superstition is another man's religion, and certainly the things like that, you know, cross the boundaries. But certainly, I mean, it's interesting that people going back to medieval times didn't have this sort of great hang-up about superstitions. You'd go to the church on a Sunday, and you'd say your prayers and sing your hymns, etc., very dutifully, and then you wouldn't think anything of the rest of the week going out in the fields and observing all these superstitions about animals and about crops and about the way you lived your life, and nobody really saw any conflict between the two. It was only sort of much later on when the Reformation and things, people began to sort of question... quite, you know, was all this superstition healthy because it wasn't in the Bible and therefore wasn't a good idea. And people got very confused. You'd get all these sort of accoutrements of religion, all the actual physical bits and pieces, all acquired these magical reputations. Something as simple as the Bible. Now, the Bible itself, a physical book, was considered very magical. And certainly in times gone by, it was quite common for people, if they needed to slip out of the house and they got a small baby, they wouldn't bother to get a babysitter to come and look after the child. They'd simply open the family Bible and place it by the cot. And the idea was that the Bible would make sure that nothing bad happened to the child while they were gone. So that's a very sort of good example of how literally people took religion and treated it as very magical and didn't at the same time think they were being irreligious or sort of being unduly superstitious.
Yeah, and you were talking earlier when I was catching myself on a sneeze that sneezing on certain days was not so good and all that. Sneezing and for somebody to say bless you, for example, after you sneezed, that seems to have obviously some kind of religious overtones. Is that because you kind of sneezed out the devil or something? Or
yes, that's right. It's because if you sneeze, you've laid yourself open to interference by evil spirits, and that your spirit, of course, might possibly be slipping out of your body. So if someone says bless you, this reinforces the link between yourself and your soul and drives out any possibility of any evil happening. But yes, the idea is religious behind that one.
Here's one for
some of my very best. Really well-known ones have strong religious backgrounds. I mean, something as simple as the number 13, of course. We all say that one's got a very strong sort of Christian background with the 13 guests at the Last Supper. So, in fact, that one perhaps we can take back even further to another religion, which is Egyptian mythology. This is going right back to the beginnings of recorded history. And 13 had a certain significance to Egyptians. That there were 13 rungs on the ladder to heaven. So you'd got this link between 13 and death and heaven and the afterlife and things. And so it instantly got this ramifications. So that they've got sort of the number 13 has cropped up in several religions and has stayed with us ever since.
What about Friday the 13th? Why is that particularly ominous?
Well, this is a combination of two things. This is fear of the number 13, which actually has a name. It's actually a recognized medical phobia, triskaidekaphobia, no less. Hmm. And if you marry that with the fact that Friday is the unluckiest day of the week, it's the day of the crucifixion. And it's really just the two combined. So, of course, you've got all these things with, you know, people won't have a room 13 in their hotel, and you won't find a number 13 in a sort of house numbers and so forth. It's very widespread, that one.
No, that's true. There are hotels that will not have a 13th floor.
That's right. You'll find 12A 14, or you'll find 12 14.
It's kind of funny because you think, boy, we've gotten way beyond this kind of superstitious nonsense, and yet, deep down in the soul of the most sophisticated people I know, they may not buy most of the superstitions, but there may be one or two they still are really kind of wary about.
That,
ball players, baseball players used to be, I don't hear so much talk about this now, but they used to be particularly superstitious. You know, some would not change their underwear if they were on a hitting streak. I'd hate to live next to them. But they would not change their underwear if they were on a hitting streak for fear that that would stop it. Or outfielders would come in. They must touch, I don't know how much you understand about American baseball.
Oh, a little.
Okay. But outfielders would come in, and as they go on after an inning, and they go on toward the bullpen, not the bullpen, but the, well, anyway, they're coming off the field. Some of them would insist upon touching their foot on the third base on the way in, or doing something with their glove or something. Superstitions, I guess, become even stronger in some areas.
This is interesting. I mean, certainly sports, because you've got that element of luck, it's so obvious that luck is going to play a big role in how things go. Every sport seems to have a lot, but you're quite right, the baseball does seem to have rather more than most others. I've just sort of checked in the book here, and there are some very strange ones. I mean, it's interesting to know whether you recognize some of these. The players won't like to put a hat on a bed, a very interesting one. There's one which is actually specific to one particular club. The New York Giants once had a legendary run of victories, and they linked it with the sight of a truckload of empty barrels, because they happened to see one day, sort of the beginning of this run. So every time they saw a truckload of empty barrels after that, they thought this was a good sign. They also like to see a red-headed woman in the stands. This apparently is supposed to be sort of would help their luck. So I mean, all sorts of odd ones like that. But you'll find every sport has got them. In this country, of course, there's soccer, which is the sort of big popular game, and that's festooned with superstitions. Every club, even the supporters themselves, have their own particular lucky items of clothing and so on, and particular ways of dressing and things. But we shouldn't be embarrassed about this. This is all part of the fun, really. And going back to your point before, you were saying how you find sort of very respectable people will sort of pay attention to superstitions. There's wonderful quote found by a Danish physicist, I think won a Nobel Prize, Niels Bohr, earlier this century. And you'd think out of all the people you can possibly imagine, a Nobel Prize winning Danish physicist is not going to be superstitious. But he actually had a horseshoe on his wall above his door. And one of his friends once asked him, saying, "Surely you, this great scientist, don't believe in all this superstitious mumbo-jumbo." And, of course, he replied, "Well, of course I don't believe in it, but I understand it brings you luck whether you believe it or not."
That's
probably sums up most people's attitude to superstitions. They don't quite believe them literally, but they certainly don't want to take the risk of breaking them. And of course, it's quite a healthy thing. I mean, many scientists will probably tell you that you should always look for the third option. There's the obvious thing which can't be, and then there's the third option, which is something you haven't thought of. And superstition, in a way, reminds you that there is always the odd, extraordinary third alternative. So it keeps your imagination going. So maybe these things have got a real use here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even the way you hang a horseshoe is supposed to bring you good luck or bad luck. Make sure that the opening is on top. Otherwise, if it's on the bottom, facing down, then your good luck will run out.
That's right. There's been a heated debate about this over the years. But other people will tell you that if you place it the other way up, this actually directs the good luck whoever walks beneath. Though other people, again, will tell you that only blacksmiths are allowed to do this. I came across another one, which I don't know, some of your listeners might recognize, is that certain parts of the USA, apparently, people have rather perversely decided to position their horseshoes sideways, away from the house, so they're sort of pointing at the house to send the good luck in that direction, which I think is a very unusual solution to the problem.
I know my mother, who was... Maybe she was very superstitious. I never think of her in those terms. But she was always knocking on wood. I was looking in your book. I see knocking. I don't see... Maybe you're it's under wood.
Yes, there's something under wood. This is a combination of two possibilities. A lot of superstitions, it's quite hard to say precisely where they've come from. But this one appears to have both a religious connotation, the wood of the cross, and also perhaps we're harking back here to ancient nature gods of the woods and woodlands, and maybe we're calling on a pagan god here to help us out. I'm just looking in the wrong place. It's not in wood. I know it's in there somewhere.
Okay, yeah. Because she wouldn't... it was like... we lived in a very ethnic neighborhood, this where I grew up, and things like if you didn't knock on wood or do something like that or say something, then you were paying tribute or something, or you were tantalizing the evil eye, and say, you know, the evil eye is going to get to you. And some of the reasonably bright people I knew really believed all this stuff, and it almost scared you as a kid. I don't know that there's that people are quite as superstitious about certain things now as they were back then, but there were superstitions about everything, and that's one of the interesting things about your book, David Pickering, Dictionary Superstitions, you really don't leave out much of anything, including the hunchback, in which you suggest that, according to some people, meeting a hunchback is very lucky, and managing to touch the hunch itself, preferably surreptitiously, is luckier still. I mean, you wonder, where does something like that originate?
Well, yes, I mean, this is politically very incorrect, of course, but this particular one, it sort of reminds me of the one to do with madness. Anything unusual, superstition either decides it's dangerous or it decides it's lucky. And hunchbacks and mad people were always regarded as sort of slightly blessed by the gods. And so you could actually benefit from having them in your community. And this is very interesting, that if you go back a few centuries, if you've got a mad person, the village idiot, they were sort of generally looked after by everybody in the village because it helped to protect the luck of the whole community. So the same thing with hunchbacks. They were very prone to be sort of accused of witchcraft and all sorts of other things. But generally speaking, people had quite a healthy attitude to them, so maybe superstition was sort of helping to protect them a little bit this way. But certainly hunchbacks, this one, I mean, there's probably many hunchbacks who will sort of object to this. I remember Toulouse-Lautrec, the famous French painter, because he was very dwarfed, and he had exactly this problem, that people would keep touching him, and he hated it, of course, because he was always walking down the street, and complete strangers would come up and give him a good tap for luck. It's not what you really need, is it?
right. No, yeah, and I remember frogs, toads, you know, supposedly producing warts and all of that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, you're stepping deep into witchcraft waters here. People make conclusions according to sort of visual sort of appearances of things. You can see in a way how they've worked out. You look at a toad with its lumpy skin, and somebody has decided that if you touch that, you'll get a lumpy skin, you'll get these warts and things, and you can see how they've come. But one which I love to repeat because it's so horrible, is to do with frogs. It's one to do with eyesight. If you suffer from bad eyesight, superstition recommends a sort of folk remedy of getting a friend of yours, it had to be a very devoted friend, to find a frog and then lick the eye of the frog, which of course is nice and shiny and everything, and then to lick your own eyes. The idea being here that the shine of the frog's eye would be somehow transferred to your own eyes, and you'd enjoy much better eyesight. I haven't yet found the catch of anybody who's actually dared to try this one. I think it's second, sort of in terms of disgustingness, it's second only to a wonderful cure for the ague, sort of shaking fever. Which was recommended that if you got this, what you needed to do was to every morning for 9 mornings in a row to swallow a live sheep tick.
A live sheep tick?
Yes.
Oh God!
Which is the most horrible folk remedy I think I've ever encountered.
Oh, I can't even think about that without getting sick to my stomach.
Yeah, well, you can see how they work. This is going back to the days of sort of local healers and witches and things. What would happen is if somebody was suffering from ague or some other problem, and that they would consult the local expert. And the local expert would say, oh, here's a chance to make sixpence or something out of this. But they thought, well, if I need to, say, sort of go and eat some grass or something, no one's going to pay you very much money for that. But if I say you've got to go and sort of swallow a live sheep that ticked 9 mornings in a row, they're going to be so impressed that you can charge quite a high fee.
Oh, jeez. You have a thing for deafness also that it involves some cures, some alleged cures, obviously, that are so awful. I said, including pouring the urine of a cow into the ear. Oh, God! What is worse, being deaf or having somebody pour the urine of a cow into your ear?
I know. Yes, people go to extraordinary lengths, and some of them are quite batty. I mean, I love the ones for baldness. There are all sorts of things you should rub into your scalp in sort of the hope that this will make your hair grow again. Rubbing in bear fat was one quite interesting one. I think mixed with laudanum, which would be an interesting experience. Another one was to rub goose dung into your head. Which is not really is a very attractive idea. One of these little problems which people have dreamt up solutions for by the score over the centuries.
I guess when people are desperate enough, you know, they figure, well, what do we got to lose?
Yeah, they'll try.
Why not? Put urine in my ear. If that's going to make me hear again, you know, nothing else has made me hear again. Why not? So I guess you do get so desperate you're willing to try almost anything that anybody suggests might help you. And if it doesn't help you, well, so just clean out your ear and you're all set to go back to business again.
That's right. I mean, it's wish fulfillment. So people try and think. I mean, this is very obvious in all these wonderful, wonderful love charms you get, all the ways of seeing your future lover before you would do normally. So getting a quick glimpse of who you're going to marry and so on. You're often addressed it to young girls. So perhaps we ought to discuss that because we've got Halloween almost upon us. And this is a great time of year for doing these little spells and charms and things to find out who you're going to marry. And there are umpteen of these. And there are some beautiful ones. One of my favorites is actually a Halloween one, which is this suggests that a girl who wants to get a glimpse or a vision of her future partner needs to eat a very heavily salted herring just before she goes to bed.
Mm-hmm.
She mustn't have a drink. So she goes to bed, and during the night she'll be struck with this terrible raging thirst. And if this charm works, what will happen is a vision of her future partner will appear in her bedroom to offer her a drink. I think that, isn't that cute?
that's sweet. Tell me about Halloween, because you have a whole section on Halloween, since we are coming up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a big holiday in England also?
Oh, yes. I'm not sure how much it holds in other parts of Europe, but certainly Halloween is an enormously important superstition for folk festival for us. It's because its roots really are pagan. That it was one of the very big sort of marking points of the year. It's the turn of the year. We're seeing winter approaching. It's the last chance to sort of say thank you for the harvest and hope the gods look after you over the winter and so on. So several things got confused here. The church stepped in much later on in the usual way and tried to kidnap it really and call it All Hallows Eve and turn it into a Christian festival. That only really worked up to a point because we've kept an awful lot of these pagan rituals and things and all these associations. Interestingly, in this country, I don't know what happens in America, but we used to have bonfires as well at Halloween. It was all part of the Celtic festival. And since then, of course, we had the gunpowder plot in 1605, Guy Fawkes, and we now have our bonfires on the 5th of November, which is our bonfire night. And that's to do with Guy Fawkes rather than with Halloween. But originally those bonfires happened at Halloween, and they simply got transferred. So it's a case where the rituals have changed slowly over the years. It's a time of year. People, this one is prospering because it's such fun, because it's the time for all the horror movies to come out. It's the time for the children to put on all the witches' outfits and hollowing out the pumpkins and all these things. Of course, this country now, we do have quite a lot of tricking and treating going on, though a lot of people will regard that as a vulgar Americanization. But that's really come from you. But the idea behind that one is, the essential idea of Halloween is that the sun at this point sinks very, very low down in its cycle and actually descends into hell just for a period of about 24 hours. Now, when the doors of hell open, this allows a lot of evil spirits and demons to escape for 24 hours and roam the earth. And typically, they return to their old haunts. So this is why you get this tradition of ghosts and things appearing at Halloween. They're going back to their old houses. And the idea was that to keep them happy, you would open the door, you'd put a bit of food by the hearth and a drink perhaps and a comfortable chair, and then the ghosts would come in and help themselves, feel at home for a while, and then go away again and leave you in peace. So this is the idea behind trick-or-treat, is when the children come round, they're imitating these ghosts and things, and if you don't give them this little bit of food or a drink or whatever it is, then they're going to play their pranks and have their revenge upon you. So that's the origins of the tricking and treating.
We have a community near Boston, about 25 or 30 miles north of Boston, Salem.